Category B6, Sports Programme. News Talk Sport, Weekends.
It'll be the real test of Jim McGuinness's managership. The real test of a manager is to be able to deal with a situation like this, to be able to sit down with Kevin Cassidy, sort out for Donegal football what's best for Donegal football and take it back. To me, the way he's gone about things, and that it's very much tunnel vision with him. And well, if you break what's perceived to be his code or the Donegal code, but you have a dynamic within a group. You've got 25 or 30 individuals. You know, Kevin is not afraid to speak his mind, and within a group, you need that type of thing. But the real test for Jim McGuinness is to be able to say, well, OK, do we need this guy? Well, yes, we need him. Secondly, well, how do we go about getting him back? Well, then that's up to Jim McGuinness to go and do.
But I do think in all these things, Dahi, is that if there is a code on the team, I mean, at what price do you go chasing these players who set themselves aside from the rest of the team? And I always find that if you spend 80% of your time on two or three players, you are neglecting the other 80% of players.
Tommy, you know, there's 30 players within a group. Players are strong-minded people. You can't cocoon players and say you don't speak openly. The test of a manager is then to deal with how he deals when it happens.
Lads,
nip it in the bud.
Ordinarily, I'd sit here happily and listen to you both talk theoretically about a situation. But we do actually have somebody who's centrally involved in one of these situations in the room listening.
Unfortunately.
Somebody who's at the coalface.
Yeah. What is the story, Kevin?
Heck, listen, it's just, it happened, you know. Jim made his decision, although I don't agree with it, I must accept it and respect the decision. And the type of guy that I am, I know that Tommy's saying, you know, you look back on this, but the type of guy I am is just, life will be what it'll be, and you must move on. That's exactly what I did since I left that meeting. I've moved on with my life in all different aspects, and you know, I think it's a shame if you start to reminisce and to look back, you're wasting what's ahead of you.
Yeah. But just as a matter of interest, sorry Joe, what brought that meeting about?
Well, Jim felt that, you know, I contributed too much in the book, or he wasn't happy with what's said in the book.
And would you, looking back now, do you think you contributed too much in the book? Do you think that in some way you compromised what was happening in the camp? If you're put at a distance now, would you say to yourself, okay, maybe I did go a bit over the top. Did I do something to the benefit of the team? Was it good for the lads? Was it good for the county? Would you look at that now? Would you examine that now?
You know, I've been asked that question maybe once a day since the meeting happened, and my answer is still always the same. I don't regret doing what I did. I don't think I did anything wrong, and I stand by the decisions I made to speak about what I spoke about, because in my opinion, what I spoke about was information readily available. As people that were at the training sessions that saw what was going on, and you know, there was no way that Kevin Cassidy, if anybody knows me in Donegal, anybody knows me in the panel, there's no way that I was going to tell anything that was happening in our camp, because I was one of the most people to be driving that issue home in our own camp.
Was there something specific, Kevin, that was kind of the deal breaker when it came to when Jimmy sat down and said, right, you've done this book, we've seen what's in it? Was there a specific, or was it the actual fact that you'd done it in the first place?
No, I actually haven't spoken or seen Jim since, you know, but I think it's just the fact that I participated in the book and that Jim didn't know anything about it. And again, people will ask, you know, why didn't you tell him? But at the time, to be honest, I was too fixed on what I was doing for my county and how much training I was doing and what I had to do the next day to be worrying about some book that was going to come out later on in the year, you know. And I've spoken to the players involved in the book and they hadn't run it past their manager, you know. But at the end of the day, listen, Jim McGuinness is the boss and I respect the decision. You know, he's doing a fantastic job for Donegal and, you know, he has to be given every support now to continue to do his job and so that our county can carry on, be successful as we were last year,
yeah,
and maybe go a step further.
But can just, as a matter of interest, Kevin, if the book hadn't occurred, if the meeting with Jim McGuinness, the subsequent meeting with Jim McGuinness hadn't occurred, because there obviously wouldn't have been one if the book didn't come out, would you be playing for Donegal this year, do you think?
Without a doubt, you know, anybody.
Okay, so there are consequences of spilling out. There have been consequences, yeah, for you, which I think is a shame, because I think it should be sorted as well. And you should be playing in a county jersey again, because guys like you, the game needs fellas like you. So there is a consequences, as we have one here in front of us,
yeah,
of the spilling out. Whether that be right or be wrong, but that was the code of the team and the manager at that moment. So that was the consequences of transgressing the code of the team. Would that be a fair comment?
Yeah, you know what I mean? Like, Jim made his decision and I suppose it's a consequence now that I'm not playing county football anymore, but that's life, you know. Things happen and we must move on.
Yeah, could I just, and not to take, but I'm just fascinated from a management point of view. Do you think that Jim McGuinness would take you back if you were to give an apology?
Possibly
And would you be prepared to give that apology?
See, that's the thing, you know, there's no point you have.
I'm just wondering.
As a person, you know, I have beliefs and I have morals, and I'm not going to change that so that I can go back into certain setup. You know, in life you have to be your own man in life. You know, and I still don't say that anything wrong. You know, Jim, as I say, Jim's his own man as well, and he has his decision made. So that's where we're at the minute.
I know, just because I was asked by somebody from another county before an opinion on what do I think a player who is a very, very high profile player and was left out of the county, and he really, really wants to play county football. And I was asked my opinion. I said, I'll tell you what he should do. He should go down on his knees in front of the manager if he really, really wants to play for the county and he's prepared to do anything, and apologise or play the game that the manager wants him to play if he really, really wants to play. And the retort to me was, well, I don't think he'll go that far. And I said, well, I don't think he really, really wants to play county football.
We must remember, you know, yeah, Gaelic football is fantastic, and it's a bit, in my opinion, it's the best sport in the world, you know. But then the day, life's life, and you have to be a person, and you have to be comfortable with the decisions you make in life. And you know, I suppose we've seen issues throughout the years. But if, at this moment in time, I'm happy with what I did, and maybe that guy that we're speaking is happy as well. So we don't know unless you let's see that person.
We played exactly 15 minutes here. Scrum down Ulster, just outside their 10-meter line, 15 meters in from the right wing. It's Ruan Pienaar. He just signed a new 2-year deal at the back end of last year. He loves where he's at right now. Pienaar waiting for the offload from Wannenberg. There it is, inside to Trimble. Trimble tries to go down the middle past O'Gara, but O'Gara refused to budge, and he made a very good tackle. Great technique from the Ireland fly half. Lovely spinning ball from Humphreys to Terblanche, and away down the left wing goes Craig Gilroy. He's got Humphreys inside him. He ignores him. Oh, what a run from Gilroy. This will be a magnificent try, and Ulster have got over for one of the tries of the season. What a start for them. They lead Munster by 11 points to nil, and the dancing twinkle toes of Craig Gilroy, one of the real up-and-coming stars of Irish rugby, a serious blow to the hopes of Munster and Thomond Park.
Some great handling by Ulster across the back line, but when it got to Craig Gilroy, you said, yeah, Dennis Hurley had him. You know, he was 3 or 4 yards from the sideline. Suddenly, afterburners go on, bang, he's gone. Burns him on the outside, step inside. He broke 3 different tackles to get to score, but tackled on the line, still managed to get there. That is a try of 55 yards. Absolutely fantastic play.
And rewind it back, that exact scrum Ulster did last week. Right-hand field scrum, Trimble comes in off the blind side, soaks in the whole of the Munster back row and the Munster midfield, and leaves then. Then it becomes an easier run for Gilroy, because it's a one-on-one, and I think he has the pace, certainly has the pace on Hurley.
How difficult was it to maintain your basketball career and a drug habit at the same time? It seems like these two things just can't coalesce at all. And yet, again, in the documentary, there's this amazing footage of a game, I think it's against UMass, where you've been up all night caning it and go out and play an absolutely amazing game, draining shots, driving to the basket, just playing brilliantly. And it seemed as if you could maybe, in your own mind, accommodate the lifestyle and playing to a very high level for a period of time.
You know, you think you can, you know, and I got lucky that night. And that's the part of the documentary that I absolutely despise. Because in reality, I should have went into that game and probably dropped on the court, you know, of a heart attack. No, that's what, you know, really at the end of the day should happen. Not go out there and get the MVP of the game and score a bunch of points. You know, I don't want to send any mixed messages here. People say, well, you know, you made it to the pros. That's okay. I made it to the pros, but once I jumped into heroin and OxyContin, my career started in Denver and ended in Tehran, Iran. You know, it was a rapid descent from year to year. My price tag and my location severely, severely dropped, and my career fell off.
What was it like living in Tehran? You were still obviously addicted in Tehran. How did you source drugs in Tehran? It seems like it's, you know, it must be an incredibly difficult thing to do.
Oh, it was. I mean, it was like the underground tunnel. You know, I found a taxi cab driver that was willing to come by my house every night at around 2 a.m. when everybody was sleeping. He'd park outside my house. He'd call me. I'd go to my window. I'd drop the money and he'd throw it back up to my room. He'd jump in his taxi and take off. You know, you can find drugs everywhere. You know, every country I played in, China, Italy, Turkey, Warsaw, Tehran, there's drugs on every street if you want to get to that street, you know, and you're willing to take the chance. You know, one thing I found out, people would always tell me, oh, you got to get out of Fall River. Fall River is a tough blue-collar town, and they'd say, you know, Fall River's your downfall. Fall River wasn't my downfall. I was my downfall. You know, because I'm in Fall River I'm in four over quite a bit nowadays, and I'm not getting high. You know, until I fix myself, I could be nowhere. I could be nowhere without being high.
Did you still enjoy playing basketball when you were in China and Turkey and in Tehran, or at that stage had it become simply a way of accessing money to access drugs?
It was all about accessing money to access drugs. It was a daily. It was harder than playing professional basketball. You know, I was a professional junkie. You know, my mind, my body, my soul was consumed every day by drugs.
Even when you get to the NBA and you end up at the Celtics, by that stage, probably because you were already on drugs, maybe that could have been something you would have enjoyed if you hadn't already been addicted.
Of course. I mean, I can cherish those moments now. You know, I can look back at wearing a Celtics jersey and being a local kid who made it to that level. I can appreciate that now. I couldn't appreciate that then. I was worried where my dope dealer was. You know, I was always 6 hours ahead of myself. How can you cherish the moment you're in when you're always 6 hours ahead of yourself? I was always making plans for the next move. You know, I wasn't thinking about the game, the practice, you know, putting on a jersey. I was always making sure if my drug dealer was going to be at the game, after the game. I mean, it's constant chaos. You know, it's living 6 hours at a time. It's misery.
It's really unbelievable to think that you could continue to play and to be an addict like this. And then, I guess, Chris, the most important thing is to stress that you managed to claw a way out from all of this. At the same time, you've clawed a way out and clawed a way back now where you're able to sit and talk to us here in Ireland and, as you've done, all across the United States to tell your story.
You know, I'm still clawing back. You know, there is no end game to recovery. You know what I mean? There is no come back. Just still come and come every day, you know? And that's how I look at it. You know, it was either die, go to jail, or live. I mean, it's that simple. And thank God I had angels above who were willing to help and help me see the light. And, you know, I'm still clawing. Trust me, I claw every day. And people look at me now and they say, oh, you poor thing, you're going to have to deal with this for the rest of your life. And I look at them and I say, poor thing. I was a poor thing 4 years ago. Don't look at me. Don't look at me now with sympathy. You know, this is a life second to none I'm living. You know, there was a time in my life I woke up every morning, hostage, prisoner. And now I wake up with the utmost, you know, dignity, pride, self-esteem, and say, let's go, let's take another day.
You know, kicking into the hill, it's what players dream of, that's what it's all about. But I just felt that his follow-through, he seemed to have stabbed him.
Here's Brian Sheehan now for Kerry, he's 5 metres from goal. Brian Sheehan looks in towards Darren O'Sullivan.
Oh, my God.
That is one of the most cheeky and glorious finishes we have ever seen at Croke Park. It was stayed out of the Gianfranco Zola copybook because the ball was fisted behind Darren O'Sullivan and he flicked the ball between his legs, off his heel, into the back of the net. That will be replayed for years and years to come, Liam Hayes.
It will indeed. I mean, it was amazing from Darren O'Sullivan. You'd hate to think if he'd missed it, he would have been slated for even trying to do something like that. But it worked for him. Brian Sheehan slipped the ball in, and it was just sublime from O'Sullivan.
I've never seen anything like that in a Gaelic football field, Dermot Early. In all my years of watching football, I've never seen anybody attempt something as cheeky as that.
No, it's unreal. I was blown away.
Like,
if it didn't work out, he was going to be getting the finger on the sideline.
The biggest question I get asked is, what was it like to play for Ireland? And to sum up what it was like, 1990, I obviously get picked, go get on the plane. I'm number 21. I don't think I'm going to play any part of that World Cup. I'm thinking I'm going for the crack. I'm just going to be there. I'm going to enjoy it. And hopefully my career will take off from there. So anyway, 26 minutes, I've gone in the Italy game. And Jack looks at me and he's looking at Morris Setters and he's talking away. And in fact, I was warming up in 100 degrees. I was doing things like that across Jack, like trying to... doing all things like that just to get his attention. Anyway, he went, you're going on. So he sent me on, and Ray Outen, in his disgust, right, come off. And I went like to shake his hand. He totally blanked me, right? Little dwarf, right? So it goes on. I get 26 minutes against this Italian team that I've been watching on Channel 4. Baresi, Baggio, Maldini. I'm running up against Maldini. Oh, what a good look at him, by the way. Flipping it. So anyway, we then play the Mexico game and me and John get thrown on. We're 2-0 down and I get on. John's obviously arguing with the fourth official.
For 5 minutes.
Yeah, call him everything under the sun. And then I managed to get on. I crossed the ball. John scores the goal. We get beat 2-1. So then a couple of days later, we've obviously got Norway where we need this draw. And I get a phone call from Jack Charlton. Can you come to my room? So I'm thinking, what have me and Gary Kelly done now? Because we used to do all kinds, like tip rooms upside down and leave little packages under the bed. And
ah, you're also...
Yeah, yeah. Toothbrushes, all kinds of stuff used to go on. So anyway, I go to see Jack and he says to me, listen, he said, you're playing tomorrow against Norway. Of course, I couldn't believe it. He said, get your head down, get some sleep, because I didn't sleep a wink. So I managed to get to Giant Stadium. And then we go out and I'll set the scene. There's like 100,000 people at Giant Stadium. It's 100 degrees. There's millions watching around the world. My family and my friends are in the crowd. It's the most proudest moment of my life. We come out onto the pitch. Ireland have lined up here. Norway have lined up here. And the referee's in the middle, like you see with the Champions League now. So the national anthem starts. Anyway, I've got my chest out. I've got John Aldridge here and I've got Roy Keane standing this side of me. I used to try and stand next to one of my heroes because I used to think he'd rub off on me and I'd play even better. So I had John there. Roy was really his. So I'm standing there with my chest out like this. So anyway, I've looked down the line and Andy Townsend, he's whispered into Paddy Bonner's ear. And then Paddy Bonner's then whispered into Teddy Phelan's ear. Then it goes into Paul McGrath's and it goes down the line into Steve Staunton's. So it's coming up to John and I'm thinking to myself, when John comes to me, all you've got to do, because I'm not the brightest button in the box, I'm thinking to myself, just listen, right? It's obviously going to be last minute instructions, like don't give the ball away, you know, keep it tight, we only need a draw. I'm thinking it's going to be instructions like this. So I'm standing there with my chest out. So next thing, John leans across and he just whispers in me and he goes, row F, Baird with the Viking hat. He went, look at the size of her boobs. And then he went to me, pass it on. So I've gone, Jesus Christ, they're massive. So I've gone, Jesus Christ, it's Roy. And I went to all the, it's Roy. He went, just tell him. So I went, I can't. He went, just tell him. So I went, keep it tight, Roy. Don't give the ball away. Don't give anything stupid. That's the truth.
Kevin Caban, what's going on?
Yeah, it was a great ball into the 6-yard box by David Silva on the right side and from the corner. And Dzeko with a simple header, really. He climbed all over the QPR back four. It's 2-2 now here now at the Etihad. And now there's 3 or 4 minutes left on the clock for City to try and win the league.
All right, 2.5 minutes left of the season. Let's go to Dave McIntyre, the Stadium of Light. Dave.
Into the last few seconds of 2 minutes of additional time at the end of the 90, Jaron. It's still Sunderland 0, Manchester United 1. But realisation setting in amongst the Manchester United fans now that one more goal from City and their celebrations will be absolutely cut short here at the Stadium of Light. United are bringing the ball into the corners, just trying to make sure they get to the full-time whistle and then they can just go to the radios and see, will there be a trophy presentation taking place at the Stadium of Light? Full-time whistle has just gone, blown by Howard Webb. It's finished Sunderland 0, Manchester United 1. An agonising couple of minutes remaining for the Manchester United players, fans and management here at the Stadium of Light.
Yeah, I don't know if it's going to be too agonising, Dave. There are 100 seconds left for Manchester City to pull something out against QPR. It's taken them so long so far in the second half to get the chances that they need. Oh, it's a goal! It's Aguero! Kevin Caban!
This is incredible! Absolutely incredible! The ball breaks to Aguero on the right wing and he just smashes it past Paddy Kenny. I mean, the QPR defence has deflated, they're on the floor, the Man City bench, they're all on the pitch. Joe Hart's running to the crowd on his own. Everyone's just all over the place. The City fans have erupted. The last 2 minutes of this game is incredible, absolutely incredible.
How did it happen?
Man City just carried the ball further and further up the pitch. De Jong had a shot from the edge of the box. The QPR defence blocked the shot. The ball then broke to Aguero on the just inside the box on the right-hand side. He had a free strike at goal and he just smashed it past Paddy Kenny. And it looks like he's game over. It looks like this is Man City's title now.
This is the greatest thing that's ever happened in football.
Well, all the Man City supporters are just walking out. They're all around me now. They're literally walking out the stadium. That's it. 2 minutes to go. That's it. The season's over with. And then Aguero, he skipped past the challenge into the box and then smashed it past him. A lady walked past me about 2 minutes ago in tears, floods of tears, walking out of the stadium. That was it. Man City's season's over with then. And now all of a sudden, it's game over. And that's it. Man City's title. I'm sure of it now.
It's Man City 3, Queen's Park Rangers 2. They're still playing. They're not playing anymore at the Stadium of Light. Presumably, Dave, the news has filtered through.
Oh, hazard watcher. All of the Sunderland fans are doing the Manchester City Poznan celebration, all bouncing with their backs to the Manchester United away support. It was incredible. For the second time this afternoon, it's like a bomb had hit the Stadium of Light as the Manchester United...
Dave, Kevin Kilbane, Manchester City are the champions.
Absolutely amazing. The Man City fans are just strolling onto the pitch now. There's thousands of them. What a wonderful occasion this is for the Man City supporters. 5 minutes before the end of the game, it's game over. They've not won the title. That's it. And as ever in typical Manchester City fashion, they leave it till the death. It's never straightforward with Man City. And you have to say, it's just amazing. Absolutely amazing.
It's a pitch invasion, an old school 1980s pitch invasion. It's like the All-Ireland final, to be honest.
It is. They're saying everyone's coming on. Everyone's desperate to get on. They're all on
the
pitch.
We are City. Super City. We are City. Super City.
The City fans, honestly...
I'm taking over the radio booth as well.
Yeah, I'm getting mobbed myself here now as well. It's just incredible. News Talk 106 to 108.